Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the product manager for iZotope's Neutron plugin, and that's Matt Hines. First of all, there's something happening in the music business that you should know about, and that's a brain drain. Music execs are jumping from major labels and from positions of power within the music business, and they're jumping to some high-profile tech companies. Now, for instance, Sony CEO Tony Linton just jumped to Snapchat this last week. Now, he was in charge of all of Sony Entertainment, which meant Sony Music, which meant Sony Pictures, and Sony Publishing, ATV Publishing. So this was a super high-profile job and obviously well-paying. And for him to jump to Snapchat, and actually it's Snap Incorporated, which is the company that owns Snapchat. Now, this is something that's actually happened a lot in the last few years. For instance, last year, Lear Cohen from Universal Music went to YouTube. Highly unusual, who would have thought? And this is a guy that's been at the forefront of record labels for 20 years. Before that, a few years ago, Jimmy Iovine, again from Universal to Apple, but part of that was the fact that Apple bought Beats Music, which he also owned. And also last year, Troy Carter, who is a big-time manager for Lady Gaga, Meghan Trainor, and many others, jumped to Spotify. So why do you think this is happening? Is it more money? Is it more exciting? Is the culture newer? And that could be a big part of it, because don't forget, the music industry has an ingrained culture that's more or less 100 years old and isn't moving too much. It's like a big ship in the ocean. It takes a whole lot in order to change it. A tech company, even if it's public, can move a lot faster and, again, is much more cutting edge. And I think that's a lot more attractive for many of the execs. So I think we're going to see more of this, and it's definitely to the detriment of the music business for that to be happening. We want to keep our best and our brightest inside the music business to help it grow and to help it move forward. And the more we lose to the tech business, the more we're going to find the music business is actually going to be part of the tech business. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. The fourth editions of both my Mixing Engineer's Handbook and the Recording Engineer's Handbook are now available on Amazon and soon coming to a bookstore near you. You can read excerpts and find out more details by going to bobbyosinski.com. Now, another thing I want to talk about is the tuning debate, 440 versus 432. So A440 has been a standard, and for much of our lives, it's been the standard. So we tune everything. A is always 440. It wasn't like that in the past, though. This is only recent, and it's less than 100 years that this has been the case. Prior to that, 432 was frequently used as a tuning standard. So the United States actually took up A440 in 1936. And the world followed in 1953. You can see there's a big lag there. There's a conspiracy theory, and I don't know how well-founded it is, but there's a conspiracy theory that says that a combination of the Rockefeller Foundation and the Nazis were behind having the tuning standard at 440. And the reason why is 440 feels somewhat unnatural, and as a result, what ends up happening is people who listen to music based at A440 are somewhat more agitated and are somewhat more distressed, while A432 actually feels better. There's actually something to that, not so much the Nazi Rockefeller conspiracy theory, but the fact that A432 does actually feel better, surprisingly enough. When you listen to the same piece of music that's played at 440 versus 432, at least I always feel that I like the one 432 better. It just feels better. And there's some scientific basis for this as well. The Pythagorean harmonic ratios actually line up with that. So 432 actually falls within those harmonic ratios as an A. The Earth's frequency is 8 hertz, which is divisible into 432. The Sun is 144, which is the third harmonic of 432. And you'll find a lot of healing instruments like Tibetan bowls, for instance, and certain flutes are all at 432. So there's some precedent for this. And I think you'll find there are some workstations, Logic is a real good one for this actually, where you can retune things from 440 to 432. And I'll tell you, every time I've heard it, I like 432 better. Now, there's also other things that I like different tunings to, and I'm not the only one, but this just goes to show you. I've always felt that guitars, for instance, should be an E-flat instrument because it just feels better playing that way, and it sounds better too. And some of the world's greatest guitar players have always detuned. Hendrix is one, and Stevie Ray Vaughan is another, and Jeff Beck is yet another, and I think you'll find that E-flat just works better for some reason. In some cases, even D works better for a guitar. So this 440 versus 432 is pretty interesting. I don't think it's ever going to change, and certainly it probably shouldn't because the whole world would have to change to make this worthwhile. But it's worth exploring because there's something to this 432 hertz tuning standard that does feel better. So try for yourself and let me know what you think. Isotope's Neutron is one of the new generation of audio plugins that analyzes the program audio and then makes some pretty good suggestions as to the EQ and compression that will work for the track. Many engineers find this somewhat disconcerting and are maybe a little bit intimidated by it, while others embrace it as just another tool. Either way, I thought you should get the scoop on the product directly from someone who knows the most about it, and that's Matt Hines, the product manager for Neutron. I spoke with him via Skype from his office in Massachusetts. Tell me about Neutron, how it all came about, because, see, to me, Neutron is revolutionary. It's a next-generation plugin. Were you with it from the beginning?
In a ways, yes. It actually was an interesting project in that there's sort of two distinct parts to the project. The first of which was quite an extended research phase, and the second of which was actually implementing, you know, said research and findings into something that people could use in a product form. So Neutron came about originally in the spring of 2015, actually. And various folks within the Isotope building, you know, we'd just finished Ozone 6. We'd done Ozone 6.1. And, you know, the question was, well, what's next? And of course, we're always planning ahead. And we wanted to do something in the mixing space. Having just worked on a mastering product, we wanted to kind of switch over and do something complementary. So the way we work here is, well, first of all, we go out into the world, we talk to a bunch of users, we don't necessarily ask users, oh, well, what is it that we should make next? Because then you'll get some very specific responses. Rather, we'll sort of maybe sit in somebody's studio and just watch them work, watch them mix. Kind of talk to them about, well, what do you run into when you mix? What do you find easy? What do you find hard? What do you enjoy doing? And from that, we'll sort of extrapolate a sense of, well, maybe these are the top three problems, if you will, that they're dealing with. And then that starts the kind of the cogs whirring internally. We start to ideate around, well, if they're really struggling with masking, for instance, was the big theme of Neutron, how could we fix that? How could we go about fixing that? And so we spent a few months of research, first of all, figuring out what, in our opinion, masking was. You know, how can you demonstrate with, in our case, it was an AES paper, but also it ended up in code. How can you demonstrate when two sources are combined what actually constitutes masking? And then beyond that, there's, of course, good masking, which is where, let's say, a voice and a guitar are happening at the same time. They might blend together in a very complementary way, and that's good masking, but they might also conflict a little bit and make it hard to hear the voice over the guitar, or the, you know, maybe the lyrics are hard to pick out. That might be bad masking, and that can happen in different parts of the frequency spectrum. So we spent a lot of time thinking about what constitutes good versus bad masking. How do we actually know? And once we have some sort of an algorithm that can take really a data input, you know, two sources combined and understanding the loudness loss when they're combined and extrapolating that into some sort of data output, how can we then visualize that? You know, that is the key to making it musical and useful. And then we very quickly attach the idea of a masking meter to, well, of course, there are multiple ways you might get balance in a mix. You might, for instance, simple volume adjustments or panning, you know, move something a little bit more into the left channel, and perhaps it interferes less with something in the right channel, and so on. But EQ, I think, is one of the most important tools to achieve total balance in a mix, and this seemed to be where users were struggling the most, not just at EQing individual tracks, but understanding how, you know, an EQ adjustment to a kick track could impact how the bass might sound, or the EQ adjustment on a dialogue stem could actually very well affect the intelligibility of that dialogue as it relates to the music stem in a television show. So we attached, as I said, this idea of masking to an EQ. And we had some prototypes that we were using in-house. You know, first of all, functional prototypes happen a little bit later. We'll start with paper wireframes, you know, hand drawings and sketches, and we maybe move into a sort of an object-oriented environment that really anyone can whip up a prototype in, and then we move to code after that. So that was a very long-winded way of saying it. It really started as a research project. We kind of identified that masking was the thing that, regardless of what audio tools, vintage or modern, analog or digital, hardware or software, any users had, none of them really solved this problem, or at least helped users understand this problem so that they can then address them with whatever tools they so desire. And then we sort of put that on the back burner. Makes it sound like we neglected it. We didn't, but we then focused on Ozone 7. And fast forward to 2016, at the beginning of 2016, we kind of came back to that idea and said, all right, well, now not only do we have the masking meter, but we have the machine learning algorithms. You know, we can identify that perhaps we could recommend settings, and that's where the track assistant came from. And sort of all the ideas started to coalesce around the same time, and that's when we said, all right, it's time to build a new product. To build a mixing product, we know what the most essential pieces of a mixing product are. Let's do those, and let's do them really well, but let's also make sure we're bringing something new to the table in the track assistant and the masking meter.
Track assistant is interesting. It definitely works, but what I've found, as with masking, what I've found personally is, if I go in and I do my adjustments first and I add EQ and everything, then when I either do masking or track assistant or both, it makes it sound better. If I start with the raw track, I sort of expected it to be great just by itself, or at least, you know, and it is a good starting point, but I just found personally that it works better after I've already tweaked the track, so to speak. Is that what your users have found?
I think if we start with masking meter, for instance, that definitely makes sense to me. I don't think you're unique in that regard. You know, if you think about it, you could start with the raw tracks, and indeed some people will do this, so either way is valid, but and you could look at the masking meter immediately and start making changes based on that. And what you would end up with, if you think about it, is some, let's say, some guitar-based drum tracks that are EQ'd based on how they were interfering with one another. So now they're separated, but they may not actually sound the way you want them, because, of course, there are some aesthetic decisions you want to make. So I think, to my ears, it sounds better, and I think my sensibilities, it works better if you get stuck into the mix. You know, a volume and panning, I always believe, should come early on. And just at least get an idea aesthetically of where you want to take the track. You know, make sure your guitars are sounding the way you want them, or you're relatively happy, you know, with the sound of the vocals. Because I think if you reach a point, whether it's through track assistant or presets or anything else, where the individual tracks and the sum of all the parts are sounding good to you, masking meter comes in to sort of help you take it to the next level. You know, it says, okay, you already have perhaps things that you like the sound of on track A, track B, and track C. What masking meter will do is show you which areas of the frequency spectrum you could make some further EQ tweaks in that may not be aesthetic so much as, you know, corrective, or at least aimed at separating the two, so there's a little bit more definition and space in the mix rather than mud. So that makes sense to me. I think track assistant, so fundamentally the way that works is when audio is playing and you have track assistant enabled, it actually doesn't care what settings you currently have in the plugin. It imagines it has a completely blank slate. It listens to the audio and then determines things about the audio and then will apply a recommended preset. And it draws from one of 45 templates for certain parameters, depending on what the audio has present in it. And some of the other parameters, it will come up with completely new each time. It's an intelligent algorithm. So, of course, you run it on the same piece of audio, you'll get something relatively consistent, but nobody will ever get necessarily the same settings because everybody's audio is different. So from that point of view, Track Assistant would typically be recommended as a starting point. And it's a starting point that you could certainly take as a suggestion and tweak to your taste or reject, of course, much like you would choose a preset or choose not to use a preset. So I think if you've already made some settings and then you use Track Assistant, it's actually ignorant, if you will, of the settings that you've used. So that I would typically recommend using a little earlier on, and masking means that you can really use as a gut check at any point in the process.
Well, how about the presets in Track Assistant? How are they determined? Because they are presets. They do overlay an EQ. So where do those come from?
So I write a little bit about this in the manual, which, but you know, if anyone wishes to read it, would make me feel warm and fuzzy, but I realize that it's not there to be read unless extreme circumstance prevails. That said, what we talk about in the manual is basically, I will tell you to think about it in this order makes sense, at least to me. Audio comes in to the plugin, and the first thing that Neutron will do when running Track Assistant is identify, is it a voice, you know, vocals or dialogue? Is it a guitar? Is it bass? Is it drums or percussive? You know, that could be like a reggae guitar, is very percussive, tambourines, things like that. Or is it in fact none of the above, in which case we would put it in this other category. And based on that, a few things happen. Let's say it detects that it's a vocal. Well, then it will say, what aesthetic directions was I given to begin with? And users of Neutron will know that the Track Assistant gives you some subjective direction you can give the algorithm. There's sort of a subtle, medium, and aggressive type of setting where you can adjust the amount of processing or not that it will do. And there's also three subjective directions as well, depending on whether you like something more warm and open, or they're sort of, you know, they're labeled and you can play around with them. So if, for instance, it identifies, oh, hey, Bobby's track had a vocal, it will then look into that database for a set of rules specific to, hey, I identified a vocal. What do I do when I have a vocal? And so those rules are partly, you know, good best practices as sort of come up with by many mix engineers, folks who are on the beta, folks who work for Isotope, and also some algorithms that will actually come up with something new. So for instance, it will first of all identify which aesthetic direction and how strong you want the process to be, and then choose one of five templates for that category. And then that template will set the signal flow. So the signal flow is set much like any other preset. You know, it could be EQ, compressor, transient, shaper, whatever the order may be. And then for each module in the EQ, what it will do is intelligently search for areas of resonance or sibilance and actually put nodes there. You'll see the nodes move around so that the nodes are actually placed where the algorithm thinks they should be, not where a preset thinks they should be. If it's a dynamic node, or if it's in the compressor where you would also have dynamic capabilities, it will intelligently set the threshold level. So it will identify, you know, the average LUFS or LKFS measurement, short-term measurement of the signal, and then based on that, do some sort of an offset so that the threshold is set at an appropriate point for compression to begin. And then it will go back to that preset and say, how aggressive did this person want their settings to be? And that will influence what attack and release settings it chooses, what ratio it chooses, whether it's multi-band or single-band compression. For transient shaping, we don't do anything. We felt fundamentally that transient shaping is not something you would necessarily always use. And we didn't have an algorithm we felt was musical or appropriate at this time. And it would have been more of a shot in the dark. And that's always dangerous with transient shaping, I think. Do no harm is the rule of Track Assistant rather than mess up a bunch of the user's audio just because we can. And then the harmonic exciting is also, again, we'll pull from some stylistic templates. So that's sort of roughly how it works in some sort of an order. And it happens, you know, in about 4 to 10 seconds. So it's all very quick.
I found that the inclusion of the transient shaper very interesting, because you wouldn't expect it, or I wouldn't expect it, in a plugin like this. Usually it's a standalone, or at least a standalone plugin, that's used for something very specific. But in fact, in this case, it's used in conjunction with the compressor and EQ in a very nice way, I have to say. Where it's been included, I've looked at it and I've listened and I've thought, wow, that's cool. I never would have thought of using it there. So how did that come about? Because again, that's kind of unusual. You wouldn't expect that, or I wouldn't expect it anyway.
Yeah, well, I think it reveals certainly a little bit of my own bias, but also the biases of some other people, you know, in the building. We definitely believe in transient shaping as a sort of an unsung hero. It really is in so many ways the secret to a really powerful mix, and also a mix with a lot of space in it. You know, if anyone's not familiar with a transient shaper, definitely recommend checking it out. But so for us, we had had a transient shaper in Alloy for many years for this exact same reason. You know, if you think of a channel strip or a mixing plugin, you know, you're not trying to put something on a mix bus or a master bus and process two channels at once and, you know, move on with your life. You know, you're looking to achieve, yes, glue, but by making changes across many individual tracks within a mix. And so the relationship between those tracks is just so incredibly important, which is why, again, masking meter and things like that were developed for Neutron. But if you think about it, let's say you have drums in a mix and you just got to the chorus of that song, and you know what? And the backing vocals, you know, the violins, the horns, It's a big climactic point of the song, and suddenly it feels a little less impactful, maybe less driving. And well, guess what? The drums are buried. What are you going to do? Turn the volume up? That doesn't exactly work. If you EQ the drums differently, well, now they totally will sound different. You know what transient shaping is so excellent at doing is pushing and pulling things kind of in and out of the sound stage. If you kind of push the attack portion, it will ever so slightly and musically, and obviously in our product and others, there's control over how this happens. It will take those initial hits that you hear, the attack portion of whether it's a drum signal or a vocal, you know, phrase or a guitar lick, and just lift them in volume and in sort of dynamic shape. And that actually catches the ear's attention, but what you're not doing is lifting the volume of the rest of it, the sustained material, the decaying material, the stuff that really contributes more to the RMS, so the LKFS level rather than the true peak level. And so it has the net result of making more percussive elements more noticeable and more audio without more audible without drastically increasing the overall volume of a mix. Peak volume, yes, but average volume, RMS, no. So it's really, really useful for helping position things in a mix. You know, people always think about it on drums, but it works incredibly well on vocals, on dialogue for post-production and sound effects. It really is in many ways a proximity type effect. At least that's how users perceive the result of using a transient shaper. And it can change musical performances too. It really can. If you start pushing the sustain up, for instance, it might sound a lot more beefy, a lot more full, it's a really interesting tool, and I think it deserves a place in any mixer's toolkit. And it's not something that may always be used, but to me, it's often the thing that people overlook, but if they were to think about it, would be used as much as compression. And, you know, probably not as much as EQ, but not far off.
The other thing that I find interesting is there are two compressors, compressor modules. Mm-hmm. And I could see how the intelligence of the plugin could work with one of them, but the dynamic between two compressors is very interesting. And when you look at the settings, I scratch my head sometimes. I think, how did it come up with these settings, but yet they work perfectly well? How did that come about?
You mean how, like having two rather than one compressor? Or?
Yeah.
It's just an aesthetic decision. This is obviously my opinion, and if people disagree, then they can also bypass that second compressor. But I often prefer, rather than compressing a source heavily with one compressor, just doing two compressors in serial more gently. You know, so one caresses the peaks and brings them down slightly, and then it happens again right afterwards. And it often feels a little less pumpy, less over-processed, so especially on vocals or more organic acoustic material. I find using two compressors, one after the other, and with very gentle settings, can sound more natural, to my ears at least, than using one with some very aggressive settings. So that was, you know, partly just we wanted to respect that is how some people feel, and it's a certain technique that people might use when mixing. The other thing too is that the compressors themselves are capable of both upwards and downwards compression, and you know, there are definitely some cases where you might want to use a multiband compressor to sort of do some specific shaping in, say, just the low end and leave the high end. But then if you've chunked up the signal into these different bands, how are you supposed to do maybe a sort of a gentle overall broadband compression? You can't. You need a second compressor, you know, and that's where signal chains start to get longer and longer with different plugins. And not that you wouldn't always have, you know, some certain go-to compressors, whether it's Neutrons or other ones. But we found it just made a lot of sense to at least give the user the facility to do that within one plugin, because then certainly it makes auditioning easier, bypassing easier, volume matching when bypassing can be done automatically, so you don't have to worry about, you know, doing that yourself, and the louder sounding better conundrum. It makes presets more interesting. And so there's a lot of reasons why one, I think, might want to do that.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's a great function, and it's something that I've personally used on mixes in the past, but this seems to use it more than I would normally do it. And personally, I would wait until there was something that really had a lot of problems. And like you say, if you had to aggressively compress something, I'd be like, okay, two would work better than one here. With Neutron, it seems to, not all the time, but more times than not, it inserts that second compressor a lot, and in mm-hmm. places where I wouldn't expect it. And the settings usually are different than I would have expected. Not that there's anything wrong with that, because they certainly work, but sometimes I have to look at it and think, wow, that's kind of interesting how it came up with that.
Yeah, we definitely weren't afraid with Neutron to try some stuff that maybe was unconventional or weird, in fact, to some people. That you know, there's certain sort of accepted norms when mixing, which I would always believe in. But I think there's also, when you have an opportunity to do something different, and actually, oh, you know what? Yeah, we're going to use two compressors here for this particular setting, and you might think that it sounds weird, but actually, just trying it sometimes sounds really good. And this was sort of philosophically, not just the two compressor debate. The entire project for us at iZotope, it was sort of this big philosophical discussion, because there are so many ways. I mean, if you look at Neutron, you know, look at the compressor. It has a wonderfully clean digital compressor, but at the same time, it has a vintage mode. If you look at the harmonic exciter, it has tape algorithms, tube algorithms. It has a transistor algorithm. It's called retro. So it's this kind of crossroads between vintage sounds and aesthetics from, you know, the present day all the way through to decades past, And these new technologies that are coming in, like machine learning and the masking meter, the track assistant that benefits from the machine learning. So it was striking the balance between what do we do that's never been done before? What do we do that might just be considered quirky, but, oh, you know what? That works by some people. And what do we do that we should just pay homage to the way things are? It was kind of a, you know, where does the needle fall? It was a very philosophical and fun, above all, fun discussion.
Where did post come in all this? Did music come first before post or post before music when you're considering Neutron?
For Neutron, it was music and post from the very beginning, each one in equal proportion. You know, we had to sort of respect that, you know, we make products across many categories and we have a lot of users in the music space and a lot of users in the post-production space. And what we were finding is if we looked at something like RX, for instance, that is a little bit more on the post-production side, just by the very nature of the types of audio that they have to deal with. But every post-production engineer I've ever spoken to, whether they're dialogue editors, re-recording mixers, sound designers, almost all of them came from the music world. You know, they were musicians, they were interested in the arts, they were engineers themselves. And so really the worlds collide a lot. But of course, as you and I know, what differs between them is the needs and the requirements. So we sort of went into Neutron saying, look, we want to make something that can be used to mix in music, something that can be used to mix in post. So we need to think very carefully the whole way through about what that means in terms of performance, stability, feature set, and so on. We were really anticipating Neutron might be used across many tracks within a mix, and especially in post, the latency and the CPU requirements are absolutely paramount. I've seen many times over, people will readily accept lower sound quality that really can't be determined once it's being listened to in the context of a whole mix or by the end user, simply because whatever the lower sound quality tool was, it used less CPU or less latency, and that is very, very important. Or it was maybe quicker and easier to use, and time saving is important too when you're trying to hit deadlines for television. So we had to make sure, A, that Neutron sounded great, but B, that didn't mean we abused CPU or latency just because we could. There was a lot of thought given to surround sound functionality. If you were to load Neutron, for instance, on a stereo track, of course, all the surround features are going to be hidden. They're going to be fenced away. It's noise. You don't want to see it there. But if you load it on a surround track in Pro Tools and Nuendo, Cubase, and so on, then suddenly it becomes a world of surround sound possibilities. And so it sort of caters to the scenario in which you might have loaded the plugin. We also had to tweak the machine learning algorithm because we initially developed it to identify voice, as in some vocals, and then we had to make sure that it worked well for dialogue as well. So we had to start feeding the algorithm hundreds and hundreds of dialogue fragments so that it could understand that. Percussive elements could be sound effects, not just drums. And so that's why we call that category percussive, things like that. So we thought about both from the start. We sort of had to. We have lots of fantastic users in both worlds, and many of them cross between worlds, and so we had to keep it in the back of our minds.
Well, I live in Burbank, so a lot of your users are my friends, so I hear about this all the time, and I see them using it, and we talk about it frequently. So yes, I understand. And frankly, I don't do much post myself except for these podcasts or if I'm doing some videos, but it's usually very light. That being said, I've tried it on dialogue tracks, and it works wonderfully, I have to say. And again, it's one of those things where I'll put my tweaks on it, and then I'll use Neutron, and it'll be better. So what can I say? You know, if it was worse, then I would tell you, but it's not. it's always better for the most part.
Yeah, that's good to hear. I mean, I know all credit to the team, by the way, is quite a large team. And I know the DSP engineers, for instance, spent a lot of time working on the EQ node placement algorithm, which you can use in Track Assistant or independently. And one of the primary use cases for that was dialogue, because of course, especially your friends in Burbank, I'm sure would appreciate, you have dialogue coming in from the lav mic, from the boom mic, from the camera mic. It's recorded in a good room, a bad room, a siren happened. There's just all sorts of weird things can make dialogue sound bad or make unpleasant resonances or, you know, boxiness creep into a voice. And so they spent a lot of time trying to understand, how do we identify with an algorithm what a particular problem area or area of interest might be? You know, when you listen to a vocal or a piece of dialogue, what frequencies, if they begin to jump out or demonstrate a pattern, actually represent a problem in an area where a node should be placed? So I'm glad to hear it's working. I will pass that on to them.
Well, it's working for me anyway, and for other people, because we've had this discussion. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to get you to talk about this, because, you know, it's been kind of ongoing in that there are some people that are kind of classic, shall we say, that just think that this is the devil. There are other people that are more forward-looking and going, yeah, this is the way of the future. I fall in the latter category myself. I feel that this is the beginning of many things that are only going to make our job easier and better at the end. Where do you see everything going? Well, I look at this and I see this is just the start of things. Do you feel the same way?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we're always, of course, we're mix engineers ourselves. You know, some people here work in music, some in post, everybody freelances. And we're definitely excited because it's an opportunity to build the tools that, well, selfishly we want, but also we go out into the world and see other people wanting. And it does make me chuckle when people, you know, look at something like Neutron and they think, oh, it's the devil, it's taking our jobs. You know, I think they maybe forget that if we built a product that took people's jobs, we would have no users. you know, we wouldn't have anyone, we wouldn't exist as people, because we ourselves are users too. So where do I see it going? I think for post-production, especially deadlines, and this has been going on for years, so it's not rocket science, but deadlines are getting increasingly condensed, and we have to deliver more and more content faster and faster. And of course that impacts quality. It inevitably will impact quality, because maybe you don't have time for ADR, you get the location dialogue and you have to run with it, especially with live broadcasts. And not only are the deadlines getting tighter and the amount of time to mix content getting smaller, you know, I routinely see people who have less time to mix the content than the content actually is, so they can't even hear the whole thing. Not only that, but the expectation of the audience is for much higher quality. You know, think about the explosion of cinematic television. You know, Netflix, Hulu, HBO, they've been investing tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars into these filmic, incredibly epic television episodical shows. And that's the standard now. You know, that's, people watch those shows and they expect everything should look and sound that way. They expect a YouTube video that they watch made by a, you know, maybe a celebrity they follow or just a vlogger that they're interested in. They expect everything to have an incredibly high level of production. So I think when we think about tools for post-production, I see everything going in the direction of what can we build that will save time but increase quality? And sometimes that might mean an algorithm that can intelligently identify and process some things for you and then give you the choice to say, I accept this change or I don't, you know, take it as a starting point or not. And then on that sort of post is just, I think, using machine learning and audio intelligence to make you aware of issues faster, so that if you can take away those issues, you can get back to being the creative mix engineer you once were. You know, I don't think everybody enjoys spending their whole day de-clicking, denoising, de-clipping even. You know, they're creative people. They want to make art. So if we can do a better job of removing the impediments, they can make hopefully better art. And it's a double-edged sword, because as we get faster and as they get faster, so did the demands increase. On the music side, I think it's far more open. it's fascinating to me that, you know, I mean, I used to work for a record label in England. That's where I'm from. And, you know, they were one of the first companies actually to manufacture CD discs and record to them. And prior to that, you know, they had, in fact, they have one of the world's largest collections of 78s. And my point is that these audio formats are really relatively new. You know, 100 years ago, it was incredibly rare that someone would be able to listen to music in their home from a record. So the fact that these are so new, and yet in the past 3 to 5 years, so many manufacturers and users and people are already looking into the past is interesting. Again, it's a philosophical discussion, but everybody waxes lyrical about all the sound of tape, the sound of tube equipment. I'm not saying it sounds bad. In fact, I agree in many ways. It's very good, but then you talk to people that have worked on, you know, some of these mediums, some of these formats, and I think people today, especially with the advent of plugins, forget just how inconvenient and how much of a pain in the ass it used to be to have to cut tape and to deal with temperamental equipment and all those things that we now wax lyrical about and nostalgic about. And so I think at a certain point, someone surely has to say, a user or many users en masse has to say, you know what, we don't even know what any of this vintage gear sounded like. We weren't old enough to, you know, we don't know. So how many more vintage models of anything can we take? And sonic variety is a fantastic thing. So I'm sure it will always be there because they are good sounding pieces of technology and we all hoard and collect gear that we love. But I think for music, it'll be interesting to see if something like that happens. I think typically the music industry is slower to adopt, you know, Uber-like changes, you know, Google-like changes, the Amazon Alexa-like changes, where they're using machine learning to adapt and improve over time and automate. You know, the idea of auto-mixing is just so controversial and unpleasant and alien and uncreative, unaesthetic to people. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there are ways that algorithms can actually be accepted by the music industry community to such a point where, hey, maybe you don't need an interface. Maybe you don't need a keyboard and a mouse. Maybe one day, you know, you can actually think the way you want something to sound and have the computer just do that for you. You know, you can already today put brainwave sensors on and at least think, control your thoughts such that the right waves happen at the right time and trigger some very basic rudimentary events. You know, you can get MIDI controllers that work that way. So, I guess my long-winded point here is just, I think on the music side, people tend to be slower to adopt new ideas, at least in the past few years. And I don't know if that's a recent phenomenon, because it used to be, oh my goodness, the Les Paul guitar changed everything. You know, tape changed everything. Digital audio changed everything. Pro Tools changed everything, you know, things like that. So it'd be interesting to see what the next big change that's accepted is. I mean, everybody's recording on their phones. Maybe something happens there. Singer-songwriters will walk around with this as their recording studio. The idea that people can record anywhere is sort of becoming more appealing to people in spite of the fact that there's still audio problems on location, you know? So we'll see. It's a fun time to be around, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, that's for sure. What's your background, Matt?
I started life as a keyboard player, I suppose. That's how I got into all of this. So I've been playing keyboard and also violin for many years. I started when I was 3. And I grew up in London, sort of fully immersed in, you know, just playing music. I loved ensemble music, you know, big band jazz, orchestral music, and ended up going to a music school called Cheetham's School of Music in Manchester, where, again, I focused more on the ensemble play. Just being part of something greater, I think, was more appealing to me than being a solo performer. And that sort of got me really interested in recording, because I was a tech geek nerd anyway. You know, my dad's an architect. We had sort of all sorts of gizmos around the house. So when I was at that school, I really got in, you know, we had a studio installed and we spent all hours of the day and night getting in there, learning, you know, how things work and that was sort of my first exposure to that. And then I ended up moving to Berkeley in Boston to do a degree and continue to play music on the side. And, you know, I always knew that I wanted to marry music and technology, and that kind of really helped me refine it. It's actually a great course. We spent a lot of time in, you know, Max MSP, for instance, a lot of time playing with modular synthesizers. You know, I love making electronic music myself. So we got really into the typical assignments would be, hey, go write a composition, but you have to build the environment within which you would write it. So build the synth that makes the sounds to write, you know, things like that. And then after that, I'd been actually working for this record label that I mentioned earlier since I was 14. So, you know, at that point I sort of had by the time I graduated, about 8 or 9 years experience of doing, you know, audiobooks and editing audio, sort of typically chamber music, but also dialogue to a very sort of precise degree. And that kind of helped me get a little bit into some of the freelance sound design for video games and for some independent film work. And long story short, that led to meeting people at iZotope. You know, I think my roommate played in a band with someone who worked at iZotope. And so I started doing some freelance assignments, product specialist type stuff, making some content, you know, videos for them, and eventually kind of joined the marketing team full time about 6-7 years ago. And then a few years after that, sort of made the move into the product management area, which is, you know, where I am now, which, I mean, it's just amazing fun because it kind of ties together everything I love about music, about business, and then about technology, sort of a trifecta, and we're somewhere in the middle.
Sure. One last question, and thank you for hanging on here. In your time in the music business, and you've spent it in a lot of different areas, has there been one piece of advice that someone imparted to you, or something that maybe you learned along the way? Could be about music, could be about the music business, or just business, or just something that was an aha moment for you.
Oof, that's a deep and searching question. I don't know if it's advice as such, but I was very, very fortunate early on to be taught the value of listening. You know, you hear stories of people in studios not being allowed to touch a single knob or fader or make any kind of changes until they'd listened for hours. And I was very fortunate to sort of be put through that. So, you know, I sat in recording sessions all day, every day at this label on weekends when I wasn't in school, and so desperately wanted to touch the equipment, but it was sort of the apprentice type thing. So, I think just the value of listening, and I'm talking about listening to audio, of course, listening to people is important too, but really before making any kind of a move, whether it's EQ, compression, any kind of a mix adjustment or mastering adjustment, I think if you've listened intently to the audio, if you've gone through golden ears and courses like that, hopefully... Oh, excuse me, the phone's going off. You know, hopefully you know what is going to happen before you make that change. You know, your ears can tell you, I need to go adjust the EQ in this area of the frequency spectrum because that's just what, you know, and of course, sometimes you're wrong, and that's where tools help, and that's where masking music can help. I think just for me, the value of listening is super important. You hear, once you can start hearing things, it also ruins everything for you. You know, you start hearing all the mistakes that got missed in television shows because people didn't have time. You start hearing all of the, my girlfriend laughs because we'll be listening to music or we'll be watching a film or something, and then suddenly I'll just say, oh, did you hear that? And she doesn't, you know, I'm not sure whether she hears it or not, but she's so much more able to kind of zoom out and just enjoy the content, where I'm sort of now like, so hyper-focused on these little, like, oh, it didn't sound quite right, kind of pedantic things. But I know that impressing that upon me at a young age was something I'm very thankful for. You know, I spent just so long listening to all kinds of good records, good recordings, and watching other people work and listening to what they were doing. So that was definitely at least impactful for me. I think it definitely helps if you're making an immersive soundscape for a video game or a good mix is, I could talk a lot. I people will tell you I talk too much. I will admit to that, but yeah, it's good.
That's the first time anyone has mentioned that, and yet it's so important. So I'm so pleased that that's the way you feel, because again, it's one of the paramount things when it comes to being in this business that you have to listen. And like you said, it's both to people and to the music. So thank you for that. That's great.
Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah. People always, I know I'm not the only one here that thinks that, but people always seem surprised. Sometimes they'll come to us and say, well, you know, should I buy your product or should I buy someone else's? And we'll say, well, which one do you like the sound of? You know, which one feels best to you? And they're like, what? You're not telling me to buy yours? I'm like, well, I'm telling you to get the one that's, you know, right for you. And it's, and again, people will say, oh, well, how do I do this? Or how do I do that? It's like, just, you know, if it sounds good, it sounds good. There are ways to do things. There are unconventional ways to do things. No one actually cares how you did it. They just care how it sounds. So, you know, it's definitely an important thing to keep in mind.
If you don't know about Neutron yet and want to find out more, go to isotope.com/Neutron. Isotope is isotope.com/Neutron, Neutron. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, you can go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.